I am Deepak Garg, and I work at the Max Planck Institute for Software Systems. Today I'm going to talk to you about a very well-known connection between provenance and security, and this is called tracking flows of information, or also called taint tracking. So you may be familiar with this. Now, when I was invited to give this talk, I was wondering about what to speak, and I thought of many things. And this was one of them. This seems like the most obvious connection between provenance and security. And the second thing is that even though I'm not an expert in this area, I'm just learning this area, I'm actually interested in working in the area. So this seems like it was a very good chance to speak about it, to put together my thoughts. So let me start by explaining why this area of taint tracking is increasingly relevant today. If we look at today's computing environments, we realize that these environments increasingly have a large amount of sensitive user data, and at the same time, they are open in the sense that arbitrary users can create untrusted apps which others can download and use. So the canonical example in this category would be Facebook. If we look at Facebook, it has a tremendous amount of private user data. It has private photos, private videos, phone numbers, so on and so forth. Yet, it has an app store where pretty much anyone can upload an app, and users can download these apps and use them. In particular, you can download games. Now, these apps have access to all the user information, and although they are intended to actually provide useful functionality, there is nothing that binds them. Essentially, these apps are not largely audited. They could leak private data if they so choose to. Your smartphones, Android or iPhone, whatever you like, has a tremendous amount of private data also. It has your phone book entries, it has all your past call histories. If you use it as a storage device, it has sensitive files. And yet, both Android and iPhone have app stores, which again have these untrusted apps which arbitrary users can write and upload and others download and use. And again, these apps can actually leak data. And in fact, as I will show you later in the talk, there has been a study which shows that roughly 50% of apps actually leak out a significant amount of private data from these phones to advertisers, essentially, to allow them to track users better. Closer to traditional computing, if we look at operating systems like Linux or Windows, of course, these have access to a tremendous amount of data, and yet we routinely download open source software. We usually don't know who has written it or what the software is actually doing, and such software can also leak data. And this is a very common way of, a very common attack on computers is to trick a user to install essentially a virus or open a backdoor into the machine. A more recent platform that has emerged in this category is the web. So if you look at your browser, it has a tremendous amount of private data also. It has your entire browsing history. It has cookies, which are essentially authentication tokens which, if stolen, can be used to falsely authenticate you, let's say to your bank's website, and steal real money. Yet, increasingly, we expose, inadvertently or knowingly, our browser to a large amount of untrusted JavaScript, which has access to this data. And most of this JavaScript actually comes from advertisements. So if you look at advertisement distribution networks like Google's AdSense, the network itself is trusted, but the JavaScript that actually executes on your browser is written by individual advertisers. And if they so choose, they can try to steal information from your browser to improve the targeting. So essentially what we are seeing now with these emerging platforms, we have a situation here. There is increasingly more and more sensitive data on these platforms. And at the same time, we want to allow untrusted users to create applications and make them available to other users for download. This is to enhance the functionality. But at the same time, these applications can now also possibly steal data. So the question is, who is going to prevent such loss of data? Of course, we can't expect users to do this because users are naive. When I download an application, I cannot be expected to go and analyze the source code of the application to see whether or not it's leaking my data. That's not going to happen. So the only other option here is that the platform must act. And how can the platform act? Well, there are various approaches. One possibility is that the platform, say for example Facebook, goes ahead and audits every single app that's available in its store. This is an expensive process. The second thing that the app can do is track flows of information. This is where the motivation comes from. So the idea of tracking flows of information is the following. The user can go to his platform, say for example, I can go to my Android phone and tell it that certain data is sensitive. For example, I can tell my phone that a certain entry in my address book is sensitive. So what the phone will do is tag this entry, essentially store a few bits with this entry, marking it as being potentially secret. Now, as this data flows through my phone through various apps, as it is stored in files, the Android OS, which actually sees these flows, essentially tracks these tags. So if an application reads this data, it can mark the application as being tainted with having read the secret data. If the application now sends a message to another application passing the data, then the second application gets the taint, and so on. And eventually, if this data reaches a point which I don't want it to reach, so for example, if an application now tries to send this out on the network, then the phone will notice this and can raise a flag, essentially stop this flow. So this is the basic idea of tracking flows of information, or also called taint tracking. Now there are three key points about this. The first is that this is exactly tracking provenance. Essentially what I want is when I look at this network interface where some secret data is being leaked, I want to know where that data actually came from. Was it secret? Was it not secret? So I really want provenance information here. So there's a clear close connection. The second thing is that this abstraction of information flow tracking is very, very general. It can be applied to languages like JavaScript for the web. It can be applied to operating systems, and it can be applied to mobile platforms like Android or iPhone. And in fact, there is work in all these three categories, and this is what my talk will center around. The third thing I want to point out, this is somewhat disappointing, there are a large number of proposals in literature to actually do information flow tracking in all three settings. However, there hasn't been as wide-scale an adoption as we would like to see. And the primary reason for this is that when you actually build information flow tracking into a platform, you have to instrument the platform. Essentially, you have to rewrite its code, and this is an expensive process. The second thing is that when you track information flow at runtime, as these proposals try to do, this incurs an overhead, both in a little bit of overhead in space for storing these tags on the data, and also in terms of time for tracking it. So there hasn't been a very wide-scale adoption at this point, but I believe personally that we are now at a point where there is enough need and enough technology to actually cause a wide-scale adoption. And that's why I feel that this talk is actually at the right time. So let me give you an overview of what the rest of the talk is like, and then I will actually jump into the technical sections. So the first thing is a disclaimer. There is no cool new result in this talk. Okay? In fact, everything that I present here is not my own work. Okay? As I said, I'm just starting to work out in this area. Instead, this talk will have a tutorial-like feel. What I'm going to do is take three lines of work, basically categorized by application of information flow tracking. So I look at languages, specifically JavaScript for the web. I look at traditional operating systems like Linux, and I look at one particular paper on mobile operating systems for Android. And in all these three lines, I'll give you motivating examples to show you why the problem of tracking information flow is actually interesting, what the unique challenges for that particular platform or that particular scenario are, what solutions have been proposed, and if there are relevant open problems, I will list them. And the hope here is that some of you will get interested in this and actually push this forward so that it gets widely adopted. Okay, so if there are any questions at this point, I will take them, otherwise I'll jump into the technical sections. Okay, and by the way, please feel free to stop me. I understand that many of you may not be familiar with security, so if anything is not clear or if I have not explained anything in sufficient depth, please just stop me. Okay, so let's start with the first line of work. So this line of work is about tracking information flow in languages. And when I say languages, think JavaScript, which is the language that is used on the web. That's the example we'll keep in mind. Now, one thing I want to point out is that when I'm talking of tracking information flow, I'm categorically ruling out languages which are compiled down to binary. Essentially, if you look at a language like C, which compiles down to machine code, which directly executes, that's out of scope. What we are looking at here are interpreted languages. So interpreted languages that are either interpreted from source or interpreted from bytecode. And the reason essentially is that if we look at machine code, when it executes, it's directly executing on the processor, so the software, the surrounding OS, really doesn't know what's going on. It can't interpose or intervene on every instruction, so it definitely cannot track flows of information. So we are looking only at interpreted languages. So to motivate the need for doing this, I am going to give you an example from the web. And this example, it may be familiar to many of you, it's called cross-site scripting. And the simplest way to explain cross-site scripting is to explain you how message boards work, or how they're supposed to work. So this is the slide on which I'll show you how message boards work, ideally. And on the second slide, I'll show you how they can be used to create an attack, which is essentially a cross-site scripting attack. So a message board consists of a server, which serves a site, in this case, board.com. Okay, by the way, when I say message board, you should think of a site where users can post messages that others can read. So for example, blogs, the Facebook feed, any kind of forum on the internet, these are all message boards. So a message board consists of a server which is serving the data on the site, and it consists of an internal database where users can, where user posts are stored. So now let's say Mallory is a user, and Mallory is a common name for a user in security who's potentially malicious. Okay, and on the next slide, you'll see why she is malicious. Okay. So let us say we have a user called Mallory, and she wants to post some message on the board. So this is how it works. She contacts the board shows her a form, and the form is shown on the bottom of the slide. And here Mallory types her message. So in this case, she's typing, "I hate politics," except that the board also allows additional functionality. The board allows her to type HTML instead of just text. In this case, Mallory is typing, "I hate politics," with bold tags. And the idea here is that when a user actually see, another user actually reads this, it renders in bold. So when Mallory hits the post button, this entire text, including the bold tag, goes into the database of the server. And now if a new user, Bob, shows up and authenticates to the site and requests Mallory's post, what the board will essentially do is take the data stored in its server and pass it to Bob pretty much as it is. Well, when I say as it is, it doesn't really mean that it's without a context. Essentially, what board.com will do is create a larger HTML page in which Mallory's post is embedded as is. Now, what Bob's browser will do is interpret this HTML. And in particular, interpreting Mallory's text here essentially means showing "I hate politics" in bold. So this is how a message board should ideally function. However, if Mallory is crafty and she is actually malicious, as her name suggests, what she can do is she can use a functionality in HTML which essentially allows you to mix data with code. So what Mallory can do is, in addition to writing "I hate politics" with the bold tags, she can also write on the second line in the same form a script. And the script in this case is designed to steal Bob's cookie. Okay, the exact code of the script is not important. I'll show you that code on the next few slides, actually, multiple implementations of it. But the point here is that if this code were to execute in Bob's browser, it would steal his cookie and send it to Mallory. So here is how this attack actually works. Mallory, as before, hits the post button. This data, together with the code, gets into the server's database. When Bob shows up, authenticates, and requests to read Mallory's post, both the text as well as the code are shipped off to Bob in the same larger context as before. Again, Bob's browser interprets this HTML piece. And in particular, when it interprets the first line, "I hate politics," it renders in bold. But when it interprets the second line, which is the script, the interpretation is to execute the script, which in this case executes the steal cookie function, which steals the cookie and sends it to Mallory. Okay? So I'm depicting this cookie, you know, in the traditional sense of the cookie that you can eat. Of course, in a browser, the cookie is just a piece of text. Okay, it's just some secret token which is used for authentication. Okay, so this attack is what is called a cross-site scripting attack, a very common attack. If you're familiar with databases, there is a related attack called a SQL injection attack, which works in a very similar way. There, the idea is that you cause a SQL interpreter to interpret code by injecting. Essentially, you cause it to do bad things by injecting code where you were supposed to send in data. Okay, so the question is, how do we prevent this attack? Well, there are at least two ways. The first solution, and by the way, this is the right solution if we could actually do it, is to require that the message board actually sanitize its posts, which essentially means that when the message board sees that Mallory has submitted certain text with a script in it, it should remove the script part or simply reject the text. Of course, this is an unscalable solution because the bar to entry to creating a message board on the internet is really, really low, which essentially means that I can write a message board today, and if I'm a lame programmer, I will not know that I need to make the sanitization check. Okay, so this is a completely unscalable solution. The second solution is to actually track information flow inside Bob's browser. At a high level, this would work as follows. Bob would essentially tell his browser that my cookie from board.com, which authenticates me to board.com, is actually sensitive, and the browser will store a few bits of information marking it so. Now, when JavaScript executes in Bob's browser, it doesn't matter where the JavaScript comes from, the browser is going to track how the cookie is flowing through the JavaScript. I'll show you on the next few slides how this is actually done. And if it so happens that this cookie is being sent out on the network interface to any site other than board.com, the browser can flag an error. So very classic instantiation of the earlier abstract problem of information flow tracking that we've seen. Okay, now the immediate question is, how can the browser actually implement this kind of information flow tracking in JavaScript? So broadly speaking, when we talk of information flow tracking in languages, there are two approaches. There is a static approach and there is a dynamic approach. The static approach, as you may expect, is a non-runtime approach. You make a static check on the source code of the program. And of course, if you've done it, you incur no runtime overhead. So you check the program once you download it, and then there's no overhead. The flip side, of course, is that if you don't have the source code, it won't work. So for JavaScript, you can actually imagine doing this. It won't work for other reasons. But nonetheless, in JavaScript, you typically have the source code. But if you're trying to do this, for example, with Java, there often code is shipped in bytecode form without the source. This is going to be very difficult. The other problem with the static approach is that it does not work if your language has a large number of dynamic features. And JavaScript seems to have these in plenty. So one of these features is dynamic code generation. Essentially, what you can do in JavaScript is dynamically create a string, at runtime, create a string, and then tell the interpreter, please parse this as code and interpret the code. This is called the eval construct in JavaScript. And essentially, if you have this kind of a construct in your language and you try to do static analysis, then you are in real trouble because you're trying to solve the halting problem now, which of course won't work. The other approach, which is what primarily I'll focus on in this talk, which is also what taint tracking does, is the dynamic one. In the dynamic approach, we will instrument the interpreter, in this case, the interpreter of JavaScript, and then track information on the runtime trace. Of course, this will incur a runtime overhead and a significant runtime overhead, as I will show you. But the good thing is that this also works for languages where you don't have the source code, and it works very well with dynamic features like dynamic code generation in JavaScript. So how do we do this? So what I'm going to do on the next two or three slides, actually, is show you two different implementations of the steal cookie function that Mallory had injected into Bob's browser. Okay, this function was trying to steal her cookie. And the idea of showing you two different implementations here is to show you two different ways in which flows need to be tracked. Okay, the first one that I'm going to talk about is what is known as explicit information flow. So here is one possible implementation of the steal cookie function. Here's how this works. In the first line, x equals document.cookie, what this function does essentially is read the cookie. So document.cookie is a standard reference in JavaScript to the cookie of the current site. So this line essentially stores the current cookie in the variable x. Then the function does a few other things, basically to hide itself. If it just stole the cookie at this point, you would probably realize what's going on. So essentially it does a few more things. Then it copies this cookie into y. This is just a contrived function. And then in the last line on the function, what it essentially does is send this cookie out to a server belonging to Mallory. That server here is called mallory.com. And the way it's doing it is a bit complicated. What it is essentially doing is setting the source of a particular image in the document, actually the first image in the document, to mallory.com and passing the cookie as an argument. This needs to be done to work around standard browser protections, specifically the same origin policy. Because I'm not going to go into that. The bottom line here is that it's making a call on the network, and as part of the call, it's contacting Mallory's server and sending out the cookie, which is stored in y, the variable y at this point. So the question is, what kind of information flow tracking do we need in order to prevent this attack? And here's how that would work. So in the first step, the user Bob would say that my cookie is secret, it's sensitive. Okay, so the cookie is on the top right corner of the slide, and the red dot next to it is represents a few bits of information which the browser stores to indicate that this cookie is sensitive. Now, when the first instruction, x equals cookie, is executed by the interpreter notices that the cookie is red, it's tagged red, and therefore it says that x to which the data flows must also be tagged red. So x now becomes red. This you can see in the blue box on the right. When you execute y equals x, the interpreter sees again that x has already been tagged red, therefore the variable y must also be red now. And consequently, when you actually execute the command, which essentially tries to contact the server, the browser observes, or the interpreter observes, that the data being sent out, which is this huge string, which includes the name mallory.com as well as the cookie y, depends on y, so it should be tagged red. And this is a clear violation at this point. You're trying to make a network call with data y, which is tainted red, and therefore the browser can go ahead and stop it. Okay? So this kind of tracking of information flow, where you're only tracking how the data is flowing, in this case from document.cookie to x to y and then to the network port, is what is called data dependency tracking, also called explicit information flow tracking. And this kind of information flow tracking is quite easy to implement, actually. However, this is not the end of the story. What Mallory could also have done is used control flow to actually leak out this data. And this is an example of such an implementation. This is also what is called implicit information flow, and tracking it is also called implicit information flow tracking or control dependency tracking. Now, I'm going to walk you through this function slowly. The key point of this function, or key part of this function, and I'm sorry, I don't have a pointer here, but the key part of this function is the while loop that you see in the center. What this while loop does is it repeats, and in the first line of the while loop, y equals guess, what Mallory is doing is guessing the value of the cookie. So this function guess here is just a random number generator. It's just generating a random string generator. It is randomly guessing what the value of the string should be. In the second line, the if statement, it is checked whether the cookie, the guess y, actually equals the cookie, and if the guess is correct, then x is set to true, and that essentially breaks the while loop. And once the while loop is broken, at the end, you essentially execute the exact same command and make the same call over the network with the same variable y, okay? So is it clear how this function is working? Okay. So now the question is, how do we actually track flows of information in this function? Now the first thing I want to point out is that if you only do data dependency tracking, as we were doing on the last slide, then this function will actually leak out the information. So here's how that would work. This is not what we really want to do. Initially, the cookie is red. X and Y have no tint. There is no color on them. When X equals false, this is the initialization code. When this executes, the browser says, oh, false is just a constant. It has no secret value in it. So X gets no tag. When you execute Y equals nil, this is also initialization. Y doesn't get any tag either. When you execute Y equals guess, no matter how many times you execute it in the loop, guess is just returning a random string which has no secret information in it, so Y never gets a tag. When you execute X equals true, the last assignment in the code, again, this doesn't result in any tags because true is just a constant. So essentially, when you come to the main statement which leaks out Y, you just leak it out. There is no tag at this point. Y has no tag, so this instruction is perfectly safe. However, what we observe here is that this code has actually leaked information, and this leak has happened because of the comparison document.cookie equal equal Y. What has really happened is that this code reads the value of document.cookie and uses that to decide which branch to go into. It's the value of document.cookie is not causing a direct data flow to Y, it's causing a control change or a change in the control flow of the program. So this needs to be tracked. And here's how you could do it. When code execution, so I'm not going to walk you through all the steps, when you actually get to the code execution at the point where you make this comparison, document.cookie equal equal Y, the interpreter marks or notes that this check, which is causing a diversion in the control flow, you would either pass through the if branch or jump to the end, depends on sensitive data. In this case, document.cookie. So this check itself is marked red with the red dot. So it is itself sensitive. What this essentially means is that when you enter the if branch, so essentially when you execute x equals true, any assignment that you make, in this case assignment to the variable x, it potentially has depended on the secret data document.cookie. Because if document.cookie had not equaled y, you would not make this assignment. And what the interpreter does optimistically, or actually conservatively, is that it marks x as being red. Okay, this is important. This is not what was not happening on the previous slide. Now, when the control flows back to the check on the while loop, now you observe that x is already red, so the check that x is not equal to, so the check not x is also red. And if this is red, it follows that the very fact that you reach the exit of the loop depends on the value of document.cookie. So essentially, when you get to the last statement here, which actually tries to leak data to the web, the entire statement's execution itself depends on the fact that you've checked the red data. And at this point, the browser can flag this command as being illicit. Okay, Vic, yes, please?
I just want to say, it's also worth pointing out that if there were an else clause on that if, it also has to be marked red.
I'm actually going to come to that in the next slide. Yes. Yes. Okay. Actually, there are two ways to do this. So you are basically saying that the branches that are not really taken, right, they need to be marked. Is that your point?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are essentially two ways to do this. One is that once you obtain a taint on the control flow, you propagate it all the way to the end, so you never lose it. The other way is the way you are suggesting, where you essentially look at alternate branches and propagate taints into the variables assigned on those branches. These are two different ways of doing the same thing, okay? Okay, yes. Let me go through the next slide, and maybe then ask your question again. Okay. So anyway, so the point here is that this command is stopped because the entire control flow is tainted at this point. Observe that the variable y never gets a taint here. Okay. Y itself is not tainted, it's just that the control flow flows to a point where the entire branch is tainted. Okay. Now, this results in a significant problem. What we are doing here is, at the end of the while loop, we are saying that the reason why you exited the while loop depends on this red dot or sensitive data. So this effectively means that every instruction that's executed after the while loop has to be in this taint or is potentially dangerous. In particular, if I actually replace this code with another piece of code, so in here what I'm doing is replacing this last part where you were actually contacting the server with something that's completely innocuous. It's something that doesn't even refer to X or Y. Even this code cannot send to the network. Okay? Because as far as the browser is concerned, reaching this point in the code actually depends on the value of document.cookie, so it's going to prohibit it. So this is a problematic thing. Because essentially, what I'm saying is that once my control gets tainted or gets this red tag, it always keeps that tag. That's not a good thing. That's a terrible thing to do. Okay? So that's something we want to avoid. This problem, by the way, is also called the problem of taint explosion. And when I talk about operating systems, you'll see another example of that. That's slightly different. Okay. So the question is, how can we control this taint explosion? And to control this taint explosion, there are several techniques. One of the techniques is something that has already been anticipated here by my audience. And this technique is to mix static and dynamic analysis. And basically, the idea of this technique, I'm going to go through this very quickly, but the idea of this technique is the following. Instead of saying that control flow taints propagate all the way to the end of the program, we say that control flow taints propagate only to the post-dominator. So the post-dominator can be defined as follows. Suppose I have an if branch and control flow forks. I will propagate the taint of the condition only to the point where the control flow joins back. So the post-dominator is the least node in the control flow graph of the program, which must always be taken after the control flow has branched. Okay. But what I need to do at this point is something else. I must also propagate taints to all variables in that are being assigned in untaken branches. Okay, this is a subtle point. It's not perfectly obvious, but this actually works in practice. This you can formally prove to be correct. Not only that it works in practice, yes. So here is how this would work. As before, when you make the check document.cookie equal y, you would taint it red. When you execute x equals true, x gets the taint red. When you execute while not x, x is tainted, and therefore the control flow has a taint. But instead of propagating this taint to the end of the program, what you would instead say is, I will look at other possible branches that I could have taken. And in the case of while, there are only two possibilities. Either you'll exit the loop or you'll re-enter the loop. So you look at all assignments within the loop. In this particular case, there's y equals guess. So you taint y. This is the important thing here. And the idea here is that by not taking this branch, you've essentially leaked some information about Y. The previous guess was okay, right? That's the information you've leaked. Now, the other important thing here is that in order to taint these variables and branches that are not taken, you need static analysis. Because the interpreter only gets to see instructions that are actually executed. In order to determine branches that are not taken, you need static analysis. So this is a mixture of hybrid and static analysis. However, the point is that in this case, again, because y gets a taint, when you actually reach the offending command, it can be stopped. Okay, but the reason is completely different. On the previous slide, you were stopping it because the entire control flow was tainted. Here, you're stopping it because y is tainted. Okay, but the good thing is that the control flow at the end of the while loop is not tainted now. So if you have innocuous commands, those will work. Okay, so any questions on this? Does that clarify your question? Okay, perfect. Yes. Yeah, of course. I mean, this will work only if you do have some of the source code. You can't do this either if you don't have the source code, just as you can't do static analysis. So for JavaScript, this kind of a solution is reasonably okay because you do have the source code actually. So the idea for JavaScript is that you use dynamic analysis largely because you have this eval construct that I was mentioning. You essentially create code at runtime, and for that, dynamic analysis is best. But once you have the code, you can look at alternate branches by just analyzing the code. And there is actually an implementation of this. I'll talk about it later. Okay. Yes, please?
Although we traditionally think of static analysis on source code, can't you also do static analysis on bytecode or object code if you really wanted to?
Sure.
Okay.
It's going to be much harder, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so now I have already told you about at least three different ways of doing this kind of information flow tracking. The question is, if I come up with a fourth, a fifth, a sixth way, which of these ways are good, which of these are bad? So what's the formal metric to decide when a static analysis is good, when it is bad? And this brings us to the formal property of any kind of analysis that we actually want to implement here. This property is called non-interference. This is a very standard property in security literature. The property roughly says the following. If I have a program P, with two inputs, one of which is a secret or sensitive input, this is marked in red as before, and the other input is a non-sensitive input, this is marked in green. When the program executes, it produces a trace, and on the trace, it has a bunch of outputs which I'm marking in the yellow boxes. So non-interference essentially says that by observing the yellow boxes and the order of the yellow boxes, you can't really infer anything about the red input. This is non-interference. And if your analysis satisfies the property, then it's good. Otherwise, it's not, probably not that good. Another way to formalize non-interference is to simply say that effectively, if I replace that red input, which I had earlier, with a new red input, which I'm writing with this box, then the outputs, the yellow outputs, don't really change. Okay, so essentially, your public outputs, the yellow outputs in this case, don't really depend in any way on the secret input. And the important thing here is that if you want to actually prove non-interference for any analysis you develop, in the first place, you require a formal definition of the interpreter semantics or a formal definition of the language semantics. And for a language like JavaScript, this in itself is a very, very challenging task. So there are full formal specifications of the semantics of JavaScript now, largely motivated precisely by this problem, but they are actually large. So one of them, for instance, I think that's the most complete one, it's around 85 pages. So it's a complex language, and doing this kind of analysis is not easy. Okay, so what's the state of the art? So let's start with JavaScript. So there are two large implementations or proposals for implementations that I know of. One of these is a purely dynamic analysis, and for this dynamic analysis, there's a formal proof that it actually satisfies non-interference. This is very recent work by Hedin and Sabelfeld, and this will actually appear at the CSF conference in two weeks from now in Boston itself. Actually in Cambridge, not in Boston. They have an implementation of this, at least a limited implementation, but they don't have performance numbers, so I don't really know how well this analysis performs. But because it's purely dynamic, it's not doing that hybrid optimization, my guess is that there will be taint explosion problems. A second analysis appeared at the Plastic Workshop last year. This is due to Just et al. This is a hybrid analysis, so it mixes the static and dynamic components that I mentioned earlier. However, they don't really have a proof that it's correct, and my suspicion is that the analysis is actually unsound, because I don't think they look at all the alternate branches. This one, however, has been implemented in a real browser setting. It has been implemented in WebKit, which is actually Apple Safari's JavaScript interpreter. What they observe here is a 150% overhead. So you can see this overhead is extremely large, and this is one of the reasons why this kind of an analysis is hard to adopt in practice. But this 150% overhead is actually based on micro benchmarks. And these are benchmarks that are computation intensive. JavaScript programs typically are not computation intensive. They have large components or large times when they're just waiting for network communication. So on a real program, this might be much less. A third implementation is due to Netscape or Mozilla now. They actually have had an experimental implementation of taint tracking for JavaScript forever. I think this was first implemented in 1996, but for whatever reasons, they've never actually released it. So if we can get around to asking them to release it, that would be fantastic. There are other languages which actually have adopted this technology. Perl and Ruby both actually have extensive implementations of taint tracking. In the case of Perl in particular, I know for sure that this technique is actually used for tracking taints to prevent SQL injection attacks, which are the analogs of cross-site scripting for SQL. Okay, so what are the open problems? So on the practical side, the first big problem is to reduce this overhead. And the typical way to reduce overhead in this kind of an implementation would be to make the tracking more constrained. Okay, so arrange your program into modules. We'll see a very extreme example of this when we talk about operating systems. But organize your program into modules and stop tracking information within the modules. That's how it would work. The second thing here is to allow for richer forms of control flow, in particular exceptions and concurrency. So exceptions and concurrency both introduce new control flows into the program. Exceptions allow you to jump anywhere arbitrarily on the control stack. And concurrency essentially allows new control flows due to the scheduler. And handling these, it's not clear how to handle these. Concurrency is not so relevant for JavaScript. It's not really a concurrent language, but nonetheless, it's an interesting problem for other languages. A third open problem in this space is to deal with native methods. So even if a language is interpreted, typically you can link into programs certain native methods which are binaries. This is done for efficiency reasons. So if you have a very computation, if you have a very, very intensive computation, typically you don't want to do it in an interpreted fashion. So you write a C program and then link it against the binary. Of course, the problem is that the moment you transfer control into the binary, you cannot really monitor execution, so you cannot track flows. So the idea here is to actually do a static analysis of the binary if you can find its source code, or as the suggestion came in, just analyze the binary directly, and then use that information to feed your dynamic analysis. Okay. So this is a very interesting problem, especially in the context of the browser, which has a lot of native methods to manipulate the DOM, which is the browser store essentially. And of course, if you can do it and are enterprising enough, you should sell a better JavaScript. So JavaScript is one language which is terrible for information flow because of its enormous complexity. Now the sad part is that these bad features like the eval construct, which actually cause a problem for information flow tracking, are not that often used in practice. So these are corner cases which sensible programs don't use, yet you have to deal with them in analysis because a crafty attacker might actually exploit them. So this is a big problem. On the theoretical side, the definition of non-interference that I showed you, that needs to be expanded into concurrent languages or in concurrent settings. And it's not really clear how to do this. So this is a very open area. And of course, then there is the problem of taking an actual implementation for a real of information flow tracking for a real language and then proving non-interference for it. And this is also largely open. There are academic proposals which have not been implemented in the wild. There are proposals that have been implemented in the wild but never formally analyzed. So merging the two, of course, you can imagine this is a scaling issue. It's not easy. Question? Please. Okay. Very good question. So I am, so that's partly an open problem. But that largely does not fit the scope of the language-based information flow tracking. When you're doing language-based information flow tracking, you are trying to track information within one interpreter, a single interpreter. If you have multiple instances, that goes into the domain of tracking information flow in operating systems, which I'm going to go to next. And if it's distributed across the network, then there is no solution to it right now. That's an open problem I list on the second last slide. Oh, no, actually in the middle of the talk. I list it, don't worry. Yes, okay. But yes, that's a very good point. Yeah. Okay, any more questions? Else I'll move into operating systems and tracking information flow in operating systems. Okay, so now I'm running a little bit out of time, so I'm going to hurry this up a bit, okay? But of course, I have already introduced most of the concepts, so everything that you need is already there. So here's my motivating example. I have my old user Bob. This time he's running an operating system. He goes and creates a confidential file called conf.txt. And his objective is to edit the file in some way. So he downloads an editor of the web and executes it. Okay, so this is suggestive of Notepad. It's not necessarily Notepad, it can be anything. And what this text editor does next is goes ahead and reads Bob's file. Okay, and of course Bob has set permissions in his file system to actually allow the editor to do that. Now the point here is that this editor is completely untrusted code in this scenario. Bob has just downloaded it off the web. Ideally, he expects that the editor will actually allow him to edit the file and do nothing else. But the editor might just go and leak this file to the network. Okay, and there's nothing to prevent it really in any operating system. So the question is, how can we check flows, these kinds of illicit flows of information within the operating system? Now one thing we observe here is that this tracking of information flow, no matter how we do it, would be very different from the language setting that we were talking of so far. And the reason is our old friend that I've been talking about. This text editor is a binary. When it executes on the processor, the OS does not actually get to monitor its code execution. In particular, the OS does not understand what its variables are, how it is moving data within its own memory image. What the OS gets to see are only system calls. So for example, the point where the binary is launched, the point where Bob creates the file or sets permissions to it, the point where the text editor reads the file, and the point where the text editor invokes the network interface to leak it out. So any information flow tracking that happens must happen at these system calls. What that also means is that the granularity of tracking information has suddenly gone up from the level of variables and control flow to the level of files, processes, and messages. Messages meaning inter-process communication. Okay? And this is the level of granularity at which the operating system must track information flows. There's no way around it. So there are many systems that have been proposed in literature to actually do this. I am going to talk, three of these I think are pretty significant. The first two, Asbestos and Highstar, proposed in 2005 and 2006 by Krohn et al. And Zeldovich et al. Respectively, are essentially fresh operating systems written from a scratch that instrument information flow tracking into their kernels. So essentially at every system call, the operating system tracks information flows. The third one, which is also what I'm going to cover in the rest of the talk, is called Flume. This is due to Krohn et al. From SOSP 2007. And this is a retrofit of the ideas of Highstar, the second one up there, into the Linux kernel. So essentially what they did was they took the Linux kernel, added a new module into the kernel, which starts tracking information flows at every system call. So let me introduce to you the basics of the system, Flume, through our example from before. The first abstraction that Flume introduces are what are is essentially the abstraction of tags. What it allows users to do is create arbitrary tags. So let's say Bob creates two tags, yellow and red, and Bob associates in his mind the following meaning. He says that any data that I tag red, yellow is related to work. Any data that I tag red is secret. Now the important thing is that these meanings are something that Bob has in his mind. As far as the operating system or the Flume system goes, it doesn't understand the meanings. To the Flume system, these are just opaque tags. They are just bit strings, that's it. When Bob creates his file conf.txt from the earlier example, what he can do is he can give, at this point, tags to this file. So in particular, he may tag the file as being yellow and red, which essentially means that Bob is saying that this file contains secret data and is related to my work. Now, when Bob can fire his text editor as before, this step requires no change. But the key point is that before the text editor can actually read the data from conf.txt, it must tell the Flume system that it is going to do so. It must declare intent. And the way it declares intent is by gaining taints. So for this, there is a special call called setLabel, which essentially in this case allows the text editor to add to itself the labels yellow and red. What these labels mean is that potentially the text editor has actually read data labeled with these colors. And again, I want to emphasize, this is potential. These colors are an upper bound on the actual data that the text editor has read or that it has in its memory image. In particular, in this example, at this point, the text editor has read no data at all. But the point is that once you set this upper bound, the text editor can now go and read the file. And the rule for reading a file is very simple. If you're trying to read a file with certain tags, then the tags of the file should be a subset of the tags of the process that's reading the file. So in this case, the two tag sets are equal, so the process can read the file. Now, if this process tries to send this data out onto the network, the operating system can easily block this call. And the reason the operating system can block this call is because it observes that this text editor has the tags yellow and red, which means that it has potentially read data. And there's a policy which Bob has set, it's a rule essentially, which says that any process with tags yellow and red cannot send data out to the network. Okay. So the point to observe here is that the granularity of tracking has changed. Now we are tracking data at the, or these tags at the level of files and processes. The operating system is not trying to track as in the previous, unlike the previous case, the operating system is not trying to track how these tags are flowing within the image or within the memory image of the text editor. So an immediate question that you should ask me at this point, or hopefully you will, is how do I write a file sharing application? So for instance, how does Bob actually cause BitTorrent to share his file conf.txt? Or how does Bob, if Bob is using BitTorrent and wants conf.txt to be shareable over the network, how does he allow BitTorrent to do it? This brings us to another fundamental concept in information flow tracking called declassification. The idea of declassification is the following. Bob, as the owner of work and secret tags, can allow processes to share information labeled with these tags even if they have already read it. And in particular, the way Bob would do this in this particular example is the following. Let us say Bob tries to execute his favorite file sharing app. In this case, it's LimeWire. It could also be BitTorrent. When the application is launched, Bob actually gives the application permissions to remove tags. These I will denote using hollow circles. Hollow meaning the ability to remove permissions. Okay? So in this particular case, Bob, when he launches this app, essentially tells the Flume system, look, I own these two tags, work and secret, and this application I trust to remove these tags whenever it wants. Okay? Suspend your judgment on what this will actually do. I'll show you in a minute. So now, as before, the file sharing app, when it wants to read con.txt, it has to acquire the two tags, yellow and red. Then it can read this data from con.txt. But here is the key point. Because it has the permission to drop these tags, before sending the data out on the network, it can make another call to set label and drop the tags. And now that it has dropped the tag, as far as the Flume system goes, it has erased any record of having read the data. And therefore, it can send it out on the network. So what's going on in this example effectively is that Bob is allowing this application to read his secret data and then pretend as if it never read it, and therefore release it wherever the application wants. And this is what is called declassification in literature. Okay. Of course, the Flume system optimizes the need to constantly acquire and drop tags by using clever set arithmetic, but that's an optimization. The key idea is that the owner of tags can actually permit applications to remove those tags whenever the application wants. Okay, so now we revisit our familiar old problem of taint explosion that shows up in the operating system setting also, and it shows up in a slightly new flavor. So consider a file server application. I've shown this as an actual server. This is really a process that's running in the operating system, and it's serving files. So you could think of this as the file manager or the file system itself implemented as a server. It's a process. And let us say in this case, it's serving two different users' files, Alice and Bob. Alice's color is red, so everything tagged Alice's color is blue, everything tagged blue is Alice, and everything tagged green is Bob. And let us say we have two applications also running on behalf of Alice and Bob. Let's say Alice's application comes to the file server, says I want to read Alice's data. So what the file server must now do is acquire the blue tag, Alice's tag. This it does using the set label call as before, and now it can read Alice's data from Alice's files and send it off to the application. Now let us say Bob's application shows up and asks for Bob's data. At this point, in order to read Bob's data, the file server must acquire Bob's taint, so it must also acquire the green tag, and now it can read Bob's data. But the problem now is that the file server, as far as the Flume system goes, has potentially read both Alice and Bob's data, and therefore cannot send it to an application that only has Bob's tag. Okay? Because if it were to do this, then this second application potentially could leak out Alice's data without the system knowing. So it's going to stop this. This is a clear problem of taint explosion. What has happened is that this file server first read Alice's data, presumably even erased it completely, but when it read Bob's data, it has acquired this tag. And in practice, what really happens is if you write a server that's serving content from different kinds of tags or different users, over a period of time, the server acquires the taint of every single user and then is practically useless. So how do we work around this problem? The first solution is to propagate the taints. So for example, in this particular case, what could happen is we could say that Bob's program must also acquire Alice's tag. This is semantically wrong. Bob's program doesn't really want to touch Alice's data. Why should it actually have to acquire Alice's taint? The second solution, and this is something that Flume actually suggests, or this is something that the authors of Flume have suggested, and this works beautifully for servers, is to use a process-based model for servers. The idea is that the server forks a new process for every requested search. In particular, when Alice's request comes in, the server creates a new process to serve that request. That process now acquires the blue tag. But when the request is done, the process is destroyed, and so is the blue tag. When Bob's request comes in, it forks a new process which acquires Bob's tag. When that process is done, the tag is gone as well. So essentially, the server, the core part of the server which is forking these processes, never gets this taint explosion. So this is the solution that has been proposed, and it actually works pretty well. Okay, oops, sorry. So let me summarize Flume very quickly. So what Flume is doing is tracking information flow within an operating system, it's doing this at a high granularity because you cannot really track information flow in binaries. So it tracks information flows at the level of processes, messages, and files. There are user-managed tags in Flume, and users can also give processes the privileges to drop these tags, effectively to declassify data. Flume has been retrofitted on Linux and also OpenBSD. I didn't talk about this at all. And it has been tested on at least one large application, the MoinMoinWiki. And here are the actual numbers. What the users found, the authors found, was that there was a 30 to 40% overhead in the usual operation of the wiki, which is not that bad for the amount of security that it's actually providing you. And of course, the wiki's code had to be changed in order to make these set label calls. And in all, they realized that they had to change around 2% of the code. Well, that's not too much either. It's not too much instrumentation. And the very nice thing about the system is that 2 years later, one of the authors actually went ahead and proved that this system actually formally satisfies non-interference. So they built a model of the system inside process calculi and proved that it actually works. Okay. Now, open problems here. So one open problem in this regard, in the space of information flow tracking in operating systems, is to combine dynamic information flow tracking with binary analysis. Okay, so if you have a binary about which you have some information, maybe some static information, can you plug this in into the dynamic analysis? And this is as before what I was telling you about native methods earlier. The second problem, this was already anticipated by Todd, is generalizing this technique to distributed systems. So in a distributed system, the problem is that if you have certain untrusted nodes, you cannot expect them to propagate tags accurately. They might just drop tags in between. Okay, so if I have multiple nodes and I'm trying to propagate tags across them, it simply does not work. So what you need essentially is either a clever cryptographic technique or some kind of hardware support, possibly based in the new architecture of trusted computing. And of course, the third problem is to make it as efficient as possible. We already see a 30 to 40% overhead. If we can reduce that further, that would be fantastic. Okay. Questions on this section? Now I'm going to move into the mobile section. Okay, I think I'm on perfect time, actually. Yes, please. So let me understand this. So the question here is that the text editor, it reads, let's say, Bob's data, and then it wants to update its binary? Here is the point. The tag that is associated is not with the binary on the disk. It is associated with the process that's running in memory. So the way this works is the text editor is loaded into memory, and this memory image gets the tag, okay, the loaded binary. If you update the text editor, you will close this one, and then you will update it on disk and start a new one, right? So when you close this process, the tag is gone. You understand the point? You are not associating a tag with the code of the text editor on disk. You are associating a tag with the loaded binary that's executing in memory. And when you do an upgrade, you have to close the first binary, right? You understand the point? Why not have tag acquisition be implicit? So actually, in the Flume system, the way this works is that when the process is created, it is given certain permissions to acquire tags, and then actually tag acquisition is implicit. This is what I was mentioning. They actually use clever set arithmetic to avoid the need for these calls. And that is precisely the reason why the change is only 2%. Otherwise, it would have been much larger. Before every call, you have to add and drop things, so it won't work. Yeah. OK. So now I'm going to move to the third platform where also we can do information flow tracking. This is the mobile platform. Specifically, I'm going to talk about the Android platform. If you're an iPhone user, I'm sorry, I don't know much about that platform. And as far as I know, there is no information flow tracking for that particular platform. Okay. So here's our motivating example, very, very similar to the last one in operating systems. And that's to be expected because mobile platforms are actually just operating systems. They're slightly different, as I will mention on the next slide. So let's say I have my Android phone. I go to the App Store, which in this case is called Google Play, and I download my favorite app. Before this app is actually installed, the phone pops up a dialog box explaining to me what permissions the app requires. And then I have to click OK, and once I do that, the app gets those permissions. Okay, so this is a security mechanism that's built into Android. These are called manifests, essentially. However, the problem here is that the permissions that I'm giving to the app are really, really coarse-grained. In particular here, the app is saying it requires all access to my accounts, in particular my Google Docs account, my Gmail account, my Google Maps account, all my location information, and it wants full access to the network. There is no way in Android currently to restrict this to, for instance, say that this app is only allowed to communicate with google.com and no other website. Okay, that Android does not allow. So effectively, when I say yes, because I want this app, what I have done is allowed the app to read sensitive data and then transmit the sensitive data wherever it wants, because it has full access to my data and full access to the network. So these permissions really do nothing. And of course, this also means that this app can leak out the data. And in a study that was conducted using the technology that I'll show you on the next slide, it was actually estimated that 50% of applications really send out sensitive data. In particular, they send out location data, GPS coordinates, to third-party advertisers. Okay? And the reason they're sending this data is because presumably using this data, the advertisers are able to target advertisements better, provide you more relevant ads, which makes more revenue for them. Because this is a serious problem on the Android platform. So the solution to this problem, and this is probably the only solution I know of, is a system called Tendroid that was proposed by Enk et al. In 2010. This is actually an instrumented version of the Android OS, and it tracks information flows in Android, just as Flume tracks them for Linux. The setting here is slightly different, in the sense that it mixes language and OS level tracking, the things that I talked in the previous two sections. The reason is that, of course, this is a full operating system, so you really want to track information flows across files and on inter-process communication. But more importantly, the code that executes in Android is actually Java, which essentially means that it is interpreted bytecode. So now, within each process, you can track information flows at the language level or at the level of variables in the bytecode. And that is essentially what this does. So this is actually marrying the best of both worlds from the language-based and the OS-based settings. One flip side here, which I don't fully understand why, is that they actually don't do any tracking of implicit flows. They only do explicit data dependency tracking, which also means that the second kind of attack that I showed you in the Mallory example would work here. And in particular, you can launch similar SQL injection attacks. The overhead, because there is no implicit flow tracking, is actually very, very low. It's only 20%, so that's extremely low. I'm not going to walk through the details of Tendroid because it works pretty much like the Flume system. The only thing to keep in mind here is that it's not doing any implicit flow tracking, and that it is mixing ideas from the language and the OS-based tracking. Okay, so this is the last slide of my talk, and I have three take-home points for you. The first point here is that information flow tracking is a very general abstraction for security. And in fact, it is so general that it can be applied to different kinds of platforms, including the web, in particular JavaScript, operating systems, and mobile phones. It is very widely studied and very relevant today because of the way platforms are evolving, where we have sensitive user data and untrusted apps. And hopefully, we will see a wide-scale adoption soon. There are significant challenges. There is a trade-off between overhead and precision. You can have high precision and high overhead, or you can have low overhead and low precision. And there is also a second challenge, which I didn't actually get into this talk, which I also believe is relatively understudied. That's the idea of challenge of user interface design. How do I design a user interface where the user can create tags, where the user can say that certain data is sensitive, and where the user can set policies? So that's it. That's the last slide. Any more questions? And I'll take them now. Yes?
So there was a second system, I was just looking it up, I guess they haven't managed to publish the paper yet, but there's something called Dr. Android and Mr. Hyde.
Okay, I don't know about it, I'm sorry.
anyway, it's addressing acceptableness also.
Okay, thank you. I didn't, okay, who's done this? If you. Ah, okay. Okay, thank you. Yes. Okay. So, yes, please, James.
So, going back to the JavaScript interpreters.
Yes.
It seems like that precludes, or at least substantially contemplates, doing any kind of just in time compilation or any kind of.
Yes. Not to my knowledge. So I guess the idea that you're suggesting here is that if you have JIT, which essentially takes the bytecode and then just compiles it at runtime to binary, then this would not, is that the kind of JIT you're talking of? I don't know of anyone looking at that, but one thing you could do there is, because prior to compilation, if you're willing to do a bit of static analysis, you could essentially do static analysis and then compile it down. So that's one way to do it. Yeah. Okay, so thank you.